Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. Joe is currently gorging on his Christmas sheep nuts, so I just put down the spiced beef and the granny sweets to come over and introduce our best of show for Christmas week. Want to thank everybody who's listened and got in touch over the last 8 months. We've really been overwhelmed by the response to the podcast, and so today we're just putting out a few of those best bits from 10 Joe Brawleys in a Bucket, a horrific sight, to the end of the year with the equally horrific idea that Joe Brawley wanks dogs. Anyway, thanks so much again from myself and Joe for listening to us and supporting us during the year.
I was doing a GA night one night, you know.
Yeah.
A funny talk on stage and then question and answer, blah, blah. And this fella came up to me and he said, Joe, he said, I've got to tell you this story. You know, I've never met you before. I said, no, what's your name? He told me, blah, blah, blah. And he said, look, you know, I went on one of those life coaching trips in Peru to take ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. And he said, it was all really weird. I'd sort of believe in it. I said, but it was very weird. He said, and you believe it all at the time. And he said, you know, you had to purge yourself. So we took an emetic and we vomited. And then, you know, you didn't eat for the day beforehand to prepare yourself for the sacred ritual. And then he said, the next day, you know, it was really very exciting. You were there with other people and you were swept up with it. And, you know, you were going to embark on a new life. And then we were given the ayahuasca. And you were given a bucket to vomit into, because it makes you vomit very forcibly as part of the, you know, after effects before you start to experience your high. And then you've got this, he said, light out of body, where you just leave your body, you leave your mortal body. It's basically a major hallucinogenic, you see. So then he said, so I'm in the middle of this trip and the next thing I can find myself looking into the bucket that I vomited in, right? I'm conscious of this, and in the bucket of my vomit I see 10 tiny Joe Brawleys. This is not a joke. Holding hands and dancing around and around in a circle.
That's lovely.
Joyously. I said to him, you know, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Why would there be anything wrong if your thesis is right? Why should Micheál Martin not apologise to the British in a public address? Between 1919 and 1921... we committed horrific atrocities. We left widows. We killed children. You know, we had a campaign of assassination in your capital city. You know, and what we have done to our eternal shame is to glorify those people. Michael Collins is a national hero. We have statues in his honour. We celebrate it every year. Dan Breen, a notorious IRA assassin, threw in the ball in an All-Ireland final. Our most cherished cup, the Sam Maguire Cup, is named after an Irish Republican Brotherhood terrorist. We apologise to you for the terrible wrongs we did to you as a people. Now, is that fucking ridiculous or not?
Because there's a different context.
Why is there a different context? Because we're Northern Catholics and we were genocidal sectarians. Is that why?
No. Because if you're talking about a united Ireland, you're talking about the people. There's a million people on this island who that might have some impact with.
You're talking about tokenism.
See, am I?
You're talking about tokenism. What are the important things that have happened in the North? Okay. The IRA renounced the gun.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. That was the most important thing. Move immediately into peace. In my view, historically, the most successful peace process in the history of the world and a model for peace processes everywhere there is conflict. That's not tokenism. That's real things that make a real difference to people's daily lives, to my daily life, to my children's daily life. Not one of them knows a thing about the Troubles. First one was born in 2000.
Mm.
Nothing. Nothing. Their friends are Protestants. They're socially and sexually advanced. They're so far away from where we were. You know, those are not token things. I'm walking away after that in a world of my own, walking down O'Connell Street and then across and walking towards Harcourt Street. And I see a priest, a relatively young priest, walking towards me, wearing earphones. And I could see that he was talking, so I assumed he was on the phone. I would, you know, say hello to a priest, you know, sort of begging. And as he's walking past me, he says out loud, "There's that cunt Joe Brawley." This woman who was walking along beside me, who knew I was, obviously, she just looked at me, I was like, what the fuck? And we both burst out laughing. Honestly, I was wheezing with laughter. As he walked
And he did no qualification, no clarification.
No, I assumed he was on the phone.
He must have been, maybe he was on the phone, maybe he was talking to his bishop.
There's that cunt too, probably, you see. So after about half a minute, you know, and I said, "What the hell?" And she says, "What the hell?" Like, it was just so bizarre from a priest, a man of the cloth. So I got myself together and strolled on, and just I spent the evening smiling again. But also, you know, and I told the glamorous brunette that night. She said, "God," she said, "you know, I mean, that's so odd." You know, she said, "I wonder." She said, I wonder, was he a stripogram on his way to him? I thought he didn't look like a stripogram.
And was he was a young priest?
Youngish, child. He was in his 40s. Anyway. So this morning, myself and the glamorous brunette, before she's heading off to work in Galway, you see, and she was heading off on the train. So we were having a coffee this morning in the ivy beside the Lewis. And I think to myself, while we're having coffee, while we've ordered it, I'll go out and get my Lewis ticket, you see. So, and who do I spy? but the priest. The cunt priest, you see. So anyway, as I would, which I would have done the previous day, except it was overwhelming. So I make a beeline for him across the street.
Of course you do.
And he's wearing the same headphones. He sees me coming. You can see him thinking, "Oh, fuck." And I said, "Father, how are you?" And I stood, you know, I sort of put my hand on his right elbow. And I said, "I couldn't help but overhear you yesterday calling me a cunt." And I didn't mean that at all. I did wonder about that, Father. What did you mean? He said, it was a term of endearment.
And I said to him, it's a very unusual term of endearment, Father. And, you know, what do you mean by that? And you could just see him thinking, oh, fuck me. So I sort of let him off the hook and say, oh, absolutely no problem, Father. Which, of course, I did. I said, of course, Father, look, I knew it must have been met in that spirit. And you could just see the poor man thinking, oh, my fucking Jesus.
It's an unusual term of endearment.
I asked him his name. I asked him his parish.
His rank.
I wished him good luck in his ministry, and I told him that it would remain our secret, which is why I haven't given any details that might reveal who it is.
Dublin had fallen completely into the doldrums after 95, and you know, hadn't won a Leinster for 7 years, and so back winning Leinsters was a big thing back in 2002. People kind of forget that we'd gone so far that couldn't even win a Leinster title for 7 years. So there was a lot of good work going on in clubs. Like my own club, Kilmacud, had both started to do serious work. DCU had started to do serious work. So all of a sudden in 2005, you had a Sigerson was won by largely Dublin players involved in 2006. Like Stephen Cluxton and them were involved in that. Then you had Vincent's won an All-Ireland club, followed by Kilmacud winning one. So that hadn't happened either for 20 years. Do you know what I mean? Like, we weren't winning All-Ireland clubs. But the group that we went into, I think they had gone to where they could possibly go. Physically, they couldn't take the elite level of training. It wasn't that their preparation wasn't there, but you just couldn't take it. They would break down. And, you know...
Was there not something about you taking them? You decided, I think, after 2010, or in 2000, after 2009, which was a full disaster... In 2010, was there not something about 6 weeks in a row in the morning?
We did in 2009, we had a great Leinster final. We down to 14 men and we won. We beat Kildare. We were a decent team at the time. And then we got hammered in the quarter final. And, you know, physically they were in good shape, but mentally there was definitely issues there. And I remember writing a list that night saying, these fellas will never play for Dublin again. And I think of the list of 11 I wrote... 9 of them have 7 All-Ireland games. So it goes to show you your clarity of thinking after getting hammered.
I'll tell you how bad things got. Pat rang me and he says, I want to meet you after 2009. Do you remember?
Yeah.
He says, and we met in Cavanagh's on the old Malahide Road. We were there anyway. Pat was annoyed, you know, because he's, you know, like anyone who loves their county, you know, takes it very personally. And we talked about what was wrong and the culture and all of that. We talked it up and down. Pat was very prickly that evening. Don't know if you remember.
I do.
And I had talked to him about, you know, there were players there who quite clearly, you know, were, I thought, putting themselves before the team. And we had a very long conversation, as you do with Pat. You know, and he probes. And I said... He just lost his temper with me. And I said, you know, I see the team's future, Pat. You know, I think you could definitely do 3 in a row Burn Cups as I was leaving. And he said it after me, go and fuck yourself. We have spoken before about Michael Dara. I mean, I'm very friendly with Michael Dara. I mean, you had characters like that who are just, you know, they're once in a lifetime characters.
But they were hilarious.
Tell us about Michael Dara arriving into the...
But you had so many different guys, like Rory O'Carroll, Michael Dara McCauley, I think Niall Corky, who was there for 2 years of it, like Ger Brennan. These guys, they didn't know the opposition, truly. So we were playing Tyrone in that league game, and we said, in the quarterfinal of the All-Ireland, and we said to Michael Dara, you're picking up Sean Kavanagh. Who's he? And he was not joking. So our stats guy had to get pictures for a few of them so they knew their face when they went off the pitch. I'm not joking. Like, Rory O'Carroll was like, who's he? Like, you could call him.
Michael Dara didn't know who Sean Kavanagh was.
Did not know.
And you had to actually get a photograph of Kavanagh.
Got pictures for him, Niall Corky, Rory O'Carroll, to tell him who they were marking.
You put them in a wee book, you know, a wee folder of pictures.
They just didn't believe in any of that stuff. They didn't read the paper. They didn't get... They, they didn't get sucked into the whole. They had lives outside of football, yeah, big time.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Which was so important. Michael Dara had always struck me. I mean, I love and admire Michael Dara very greatly. You know, his work with organ donation and his work in the inner city and all the things that he does, all his altruism. I mean, we recently went to that Kick Racism Out Day that he was running, and you know, it just typifies him giving off himself for the sake of doing good, you know, not with no return. But I mean, I would have thought that at its base level, Michael wouldn't actually have much interest in football. He's more interested in the whole idea of throwing yourself into something. Do you know what I mean by that?
Well, I won't say exactly when the game was, because I can't remember which game it was, but we were playing a big game anyway, championship. It was either a semi-final or final, right? And he comes to me the day before, he says, I'm playing a basketball match tomorrow. I said, we're playing on Sunday, that's Saturday. He goes, yeah, but I promised the lads. I said, like, is it a team? He says, no. He says, it's kind of a little road league kind of we have going. I said, Michael. He says, I just have to put you clear. He says, no, I'm not really that big into the guy. And I'm going, right, fair enough. I said, just play it, but don't tell anyone. I said, just don't tell anyone. So he played away, and then he played like a demon on the weekend. So he was a different... totally different guy, and I'm extremely fond. To be honest with you, all of them.
But he was also so powerful. I mean, he was. If he picked up a player, he put that player out of bit. He was a brilliant, brilliant athlete.
He was.
But tell, and always with a smile. But tell the story about him. It's one of my favorite stories. But I would hate to tell it to butcher it. The one about him arriving on the morning of either a semi final or final. This is all Ireland.
Yeah.
And he didn't have his boots.
Well, we were in the dressing room. And you know, you get to go through all the routine, put your boots on, everyone puts their boots on. I'm seeing him in his socks, and I go, fuck. So I said, come over here. And I went into the toilet. I said, what's the story? He said, no boots. I'm roughly the same size as him. Like, we all had the same boots, same runners. You know, you get the things from Adidas or whoever. So I said, I said, I've no runners now to wear out. So I said, you give me your runners. You tape and I'll give you my boots. So anyway, he wore them and didn't bother him. Like, I'd say I was a size bigger than him. Like, I'd say I was a 13, he was a 12, and not a bother on him. You know, it was just like, oh well. And he went out and played. It didn't had no effect. Another fella that would drive him mad. Yeah. None of that. That's all peripheral stuff to him. Just let me go out and play.
He's like a child in the playground. I mean,
he's an exceptional person now. He really is. He's he wasn't on his own. There's a lot of them there that even back then, before they'd won anything, I mean, there was fellas running soup kitchens down and with brother Kevin, and they were going over doing like fucking other things out with sick kids out in Malahide. No publicity. No, not for that. They were doing it for the real.
When I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And when I was drinking, I was thinking about not drinking.
Yeah.
It was the great obsessive thought.
Yeah.
In my head. And I thought that was the kind of the deal. I thought that's as good as it kind of, you know, if you could stay off it and just spend your time thinking about it, when are you going to, you know, how long is this going to last?
So did you go into a facility then?
No, I didn't. No.
Okay.
But I asked for help and I went, like, I'll say this. I'm in recovery, and without question, is the greatest, best thing I've ever done. Everything I have in my life, I have because of what I learned there. Not just in terms of stopping, but everything I had in terms of how to actually, a lot of my drinking, a lot of everything was all about show and all about, here I am, the fucking big man or the great guy, and I've got this, and let me buy you a drink, and let me, you know, all this kind of shite. And you go in there and you talk about how bad you're feeling. And you might say, you talk about it, and everybody laughs, you know, and they're not laughing. They're laughing because they all they all relate? Or you've some crazy thought just going on in your head. You go, here's how crazy, this is the crazy stuff I was thinking about today, and everybody laughs. And you learn that you can actually develop these as Colin O'Gara called it, you know, those mutual support groups. You can develop this fellowship, which is also another word for friendship.
Yes.
You can develop these friendships through actually telling
you're not alone.
Yeah, but also telling people who you are. And the best friends I have in my life today are people I've met there. You know, the godfather to my son, you know, these are the people I met. And the reason they are is not because, it's because you find yourself just talking to them during all the normal shit, you know? And so like your father's dying, your father dies, terrible stuff happens, and you just call them. And, you know, and sometimes it's like, yeah, like I have a friend who he's saying like, we won't kill ourselves today. You know, it's like Nietzsche used to say that the thought of suicide got him through many a bad night, you know? And, but you say, we won't do that today, and we won't pick up, we won't have a drink today. And you just regroup.
The books that I like least are books that try to make sports a metaphor for life, because sports are not a metaphor for life. If I don't think life A needs a metaphor.
That's the line you wrote that in the sports writer.
I hope I did.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. I believe it. It's one of those lines I wrote that I actually believe.
People are always looking for that meaning in sport, aren't they? When it's actually maybe it's the escape from the meaning.
It's a dry hole, I think.
Yeah.
But isn't there a sort of, you know, isn't there a sort of glow that you feel, whether it's in your imagination or not? You know, say someone like Muhammad Ali, that Mailer tried so desperately to be close to.
Yes.
You know, almost to, you know, to be in there. You know, the fact that he jogged with him, you know, in the run up to his epic fight.
Yeah.
In Zaire with Foreman. You know, even though he had six glasses of wine, you know, and had to sort of prevent himself from vomiting as he sort of trailed in Ali's wake.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, who could have described that fight? And who could have described Ali the way Mailer did? There's something epic and unforgettable about that as well, surely.
But it was from the outside in, though, I think. It was preservative of Ali's image, preservative of Ali's peculiar greatness, which only haphazardly corresponded with who the man was and how his life was. And I would be interested only in that. If I were going to write about him, I would be interested in who the man was. Or if I made someone up, that's what would interest me.
You're a cynic.
His grandeur, his celebrity, his glory would almost have only incidental relationship to those things.
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously a cynic.
I am not. You can't be a novelist and be a cynic.
Who could?
You can be skeptical.
Who couldn't bask in those words? You know, I was going to say, it is always a shock to see him in the flesh again.
Ali.
Yeah, the man, the world's most beautiful man, you know, and then the language of camp is doomed to appear.
I did see him in the flesh one time in Pauley Pavilion in Los Angeles. He was standing down there. It was when he was out of boxing for the time that they kicked him out.
Yeah.
He was just there alone standing in Pauley Pavilion, and I was sitting with my wife. I said, God, I said, there's the champ. I said, I just got to go down. And I don't know. I just want to touch him. I just want to meet him. And so I went down there. I was about 26 years old. And I said to him, you know, stupidly, I said, champ, I said, who are you going to fight next? Because he hadn't fought anybody for a while. And he kind of looked away from me like this. And all of a sudden he said, you sucker. And he put this hand that was as big as a car fender in my face. And I was just galvanized by it. You sucker.
What a man. What a fighter.
Yeah, he was a piece of work, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Great man.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, man.
Their case was, we did not know this money was coming from RTE. Right? Okay? The evidence at the PAC on Thursday was, Noel Kelly was banging down the door for the next two payments of 75 grand. Yeah. Why was he banging down RTE's door? They said, that's untrue. Lynch said, that's not true. They were banging down the door.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and Kelly already was asked, for example, Kelly was asked, what percentage did you get for the Reynolds arrangement? Okay. So he's not disclosing what he got, but it could be anywhere from 15 to 35%. Because the overall fee that RTE were charged was about 257,000. Okay, with Tuberty getting 150,000 of that. Question, did you benefit financially? That's not relevant. I'm going to ask you again, did you benefit financially? Kelly says that's not one of the issues and refused to answer the question. You know, and it's the contempt that they have. And I suppose what you have to do then, I suppose they circle the wagons, they do their best, they put out a paper-thin statement. Ryan comes on and tells us that, although I get an enormous salary, it doesn't affect my soul. Oh, little children are just, they're all crying. And I thought he was going to fucking burst out crying. And I honestly would have gone down there myself and gone into that room and slapped him in the face.
You see,
And this stuff is shoveled out. And then you get these commentators, right? She's like, oh, you know, I thought he was quite genuine in there. I think that he was quite genuine. And you've got this completely superficial analysis of it all, you know. And in fairness to Fintan O'Toole, and, you know, Fintan's a very clever guy, forensically very clever, brackets, he just knows fuck all about the North. Close brackets.
This is about the third time recently you've praised Fintan O'Toole. This is the goal of this podcast, to get Joe to praise Fintan O'Toole.
But anyway, Fintan O'Toole absolutely nailed it in his column in the Irish Times about this. You know, and he said, you know, in the end, Tuberty resorted to the Father Ted defence. You know, that money was just resting in my account. Oh, you know, I didn't know that money came from RTE. You could have blown me over with a feather, knocked me over with a feather when I heard that money came from RTE that Noel Kelly was banging down RTE's door to get. All right? And, you know, I wondered why I never had to do those six engagements that I thought I had to do for Ranald. I was mystified by that, you know. But now that all this has come to light, I might have to give that money back.
Or do the six gigs.
Or do the six non-existent gigs.
Those would be good shows.
That Ranald doesn't know anything about.
They would be good shows if he showed
up. Would this be a good time to say
to say that Ryan is driving a brand new Renault Capture, which has given him a passion for life. It's an extraordinary electric range of 295 kilometres on just a single charge.
It would be a good time to say that. That's very good. We're doing, you know, Renault, we are available.
Can we do a competition time?
We are unattached to the public purse, so yeah. just to say that we are available.
Yeah, and that's another thing too. You know, this tawdry competition times. I cannot have that. And, you know, it's all the same. No, competition time. You know, which famous Gaelic football county has lost 6 All-Ireland finals since 2012? Is it A, Mayo, B, Hellman's Mayonnaise, C, May Old Acquaintance Be Forgot, or D, Mayday? Text €3, no ISIS or Northerners. Prize, one night's bed and breakfast, brackets, breakfast not included, midweek nights only, Sunday not included, nor is Friday or Saturday, no Northerners or ISIS.
See, I think it's interesting what you say about people falling for the performance, because I think it was genuine up to a point, but actually what it showed was that there was a kind of, I said to somebody that it lacked another dimension to Tuberty's performance. I said, yeah, he lacks a second dimension, let alone a third or a fourth. But I interviewed him, and you know, I know him, and I've interviewed him, and I think that struck me when I interviewed him, which for my old podcast, Unfiltered, was how he was after the interview, when he worked the office and he went in and he met everybody.
It's a politician. And kiss the babies if they're there.
And it was incredible. Like, it was just an extraordinary performance of just kind of making sure that, and you could even see it, a little bit in the Oireachtas, making sure that he left that building with everybody liking him.
But it's the transparency. You know? But it's nothing deeper than that. It's the transparency of their behaviour. I mean, I love your county, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. But the thing I always remember, and I mean,
you know how much respect we have for the Oireachtas.
I always remember being struck by it.
Sugary poems read out by the Rose of Tralee.
He was in the wrong business. I remember Leo Varadkar came in to be interviewed about 2 weeks later, and Leo couldn't do any of that stuff. Leo went into the office to meet people. it was kind of endearing.
Maybe
it was kind of endearing.
He's got a bit of dignity.
It was kind of endearing, you know what I mean? That he couldn't actually do this plumosing that is meant to be second nature in your business. But he was far worse at it, certainly, than Tuberty. But the other thing I think, and I think this goes back to that point about what Artie has become, like, there is a term called Hanlon's razor, which is that never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. And I think in some ways, RTE, there are obviously elements in this story in particular where you think, right, there is something going on and there is collusion going on. But there is, in general, what has happened, and you see it throughout this story and throughout RTE, is just a failure, really, for anybody to do their job well.
Yeah, but that's because once the cartel is established and it becomes cosy, right, and this small grouping controls RTE, okay, then all of the normal structures of discipline, monitoring, supervising go out the window. And so what you have here is people keeping their mouths shut, saying nothing. You know, then as soon as they're rumbled, they try to put a face on it. Then they start resigning one after the other. You know, as the whole thing starts to collapse, they become ill. They're not able to be there. You know, I mean, Tuberty and Noel Kelly have made a show out of themselves. I mean, Alan Dillon from Mayo, the Mayo forward, and very famous forward, he said, he asked, I thought he was good, you know, because he asks short questions and he listens to the answer. He said, is there not collusion here in operation between RTE and Noel Kelly? And he asked Paula Mullooly, who's the RTE head of legals. And she said, yes, there is definitely misleading and a lack of transparency. And Adrian Lynch said, look, Ryan Tuberty doesn't owe another 6 events to anybody, because nobody ever signed up for another 6 events.
He's desperate to do those events. Just let him out there.
He wants to do them. He wants to do them because he knows that Reynolds' heart will be broken in tiny little pieces. And his soul.
And the children of Ireland will be upset if the toy man.
Don't mention the children. No, please, don't mention it. I can't take any more.
Before we play our final clip, just felt it was worth introducing it. The final clip is from our interview with Michael Lewis, who we went in to interview in the Marriott Hotel on a beautiful Saturday morning. And we spoke about his new book about Sam Bankman-Fried, and we spoke about America and sport and lots of stuff. He was at the end of his book tour. We were the final interview, and he wanted it to be as broad as possible. We then asked him about his daughter, Dixie Lee, who died in a car crash a couple of years ago. And he spoke about her for 10 minutes, about what he had learned and what he had found useful about surviving and about grief and what he hadn't found useful. And he spoke for 10 minutes. And just at the end of the interview, after the interview ended, he said, "I could speak about her all day." And I think it's a fitting clip to end on, because while this is a lovely time of year for many people, it's also a tough time of year for lots of people, and loss and grief plays a huge part in it, in its toughness for so many. So we thought we would end with this clip, and thanks again to everybody for listening throughout the year.
Yes, it's true, Dixie Lee Lewis was killed in a car crash, and I can't do anything about it. But then what? You know, and so I don't know. It's everybody processes these things in a different way. So this is the other thing that I won't go on forever about this, but the other thing that almost instantly occurred to me within days of Dixie's death, the various things people were telling me very quickly about how I was going, what I was experiencing, letters from parents who had lost children, giving me advice, books about grief, everything I looked at made no sense to me. And sometimes there were very specifically things wrong with them. Like a lot of people were saying, "You're going to feel guilty for the rest of your life," and it didn't even ever occur to me to feel guilty. There was no guilt around the event. It was a beautiful relationship. She was a beautiful child. I was a great dad to her. I loved her. She loved me. She had a great life as long as it lasted. And there was nothing I could have done to stop what happened. And I thought, well, there probably are circumstances where you do feel guilty. And these people had those circumstances in their experience, and they just thought that was universal. And I realized that this experience, it's actually not exactly universal. Loss, the feeling of loss is universal. Everybody will experience it. No one's going to dodge this bullet in their lives. But the particulars of the experience, how you feel about it, is going to turn on what your relationship was, how the person was lost, how the person died, who you are, how you tell your story. And I realized that I was facing a jungle, and to get through that jungle, there was one path, and it was my path. There wasn't a path someone had cleared before me by writing a book about grief. There wasn't a path someone could lead me to because they had experienced the loss of a child. That I had to pick my way with a machete through this jungle by myself and find the best path. And it was an individual sport, and no one could help me. And that was liberating. It was like, this is going to be my story about Dixie and me, and I'm going to do my best to figure it out. And that somehow freed me up to like move forward. Some people, when I said this, some people have been sort of offended, is the wrong word, but concerned. Like, don't we have a community of people who share a loss and you can derive strength from that? I think yes, sort of. I think more generally, you have to live it yourself. It's a very personal experience, and you have to put the words to it yourself.
Free State Podcast is a Gold Hat production in association with Swan McGee.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.